It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
In 2020, events have again shone a light on inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now, not ever.
I mean...
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
Yeah, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hello and welcome to an all-new episode of Democracy Sausage brought to you by Policy Forum at Crawford School of Public Policy and the ANU Australian Studies Institute. I'm Martin Pierce and I am holding the tongs today, stepping in today for your regular host, Mark Kenny. Now, in a special barbecue treat, we are bringing you today's episode as part of the International GovComs Festival. Facilitated by the Content Group, it's the world's first global event dedicated to the future of government communications. And this year's festival is part of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's Government Aftershock Global Dialogue. And in this crazy year, government communications have been more important than ever. Amidst the coronavirus pandemic, how governments communicate the risks of the virus and the ever-changing restrictions has been literally a matter of life and death. So today we want to lift the veil on government communication and find out how it works and how it's changing and what governments and citizens can learn from the 2020 experience. And we've got a stellar panel of experts to unpick some of this stuff for us today. First of all, of course, our regular podleague, Dr. Maria Taflaga, is Director of the ANU Australian Politics Studies Centre and a lecturer at the ANU School of Politics and International Relations. Hello, Maria. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Looking forward to talking about government communications today.
Can't wait.
Yeah. And joining us remotely is Jeanette Cotterill. Jeanette is Managing Director of Executive Council Australia, a government relations and media consultancy. And prior to entering strategic communications and lobbying, she was a TV producer with the Nine Network, with BBC TV in London, and with the Seven Network in Australia. Hello, Jeanette.
Hi, how are you all?
Many thanks for joining us today. And last but certainly not least is Fiona Benson. Fiona is the founder of FJ Partners Strategic Advisory. She's a former press secretary to two federal cabinet ministers, and she specializes in devising innovative stakeholder engagement, media, and communication strategies. Hi, Fiona.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for joining us at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate today. Let's start with a question which I'll throw open to all three of you. Maybe we can go to you first, though, Fiona. How is the government communications landscape changing?
Well, I think we have heard more from government this year than we ever have in the past. There has been no shortage of communications via all of the usual channels, particularly as regards COVID. And that's obviously been important from the point of view of a population who are having to cope with something that is unprecedented. And I think having that regular communication from government, both federal and state, bringing in different spokespeople like chief health officers, the head nurse, that has really helped people to have more trust and to feel more confident. But that certainly has been a shift in of ginormous magnitude in the way that government communications operates.
Jeanette, you're at the coalface of some of this. What's your take on how government comms has changed this year?
I totally agree that we're hearing more directly from government probably than any other time, at a time in our lives that have never been more critical to ensure that we get the right messages at the right time. And I've worked, especially this year, I guess, with many organisations at the coalface of this COVID virus, in particular those perhaps like in childcare, where at the beginning they were really struggling to get that one source of truth from the government. There seemed to be a fairly disconnected communication plan from the federal government to the various state governments. And we're still seeing that in the you know, political disputes over border, and particularly some state leaders putting, I guess, the health of their people are more important than, I guess, the health of the economy. But I think as far as the federal government goes, the ability to speak very clearly to its own citizens has been reasonably successful. And there's a yet-to-be-published study that has been put together by a group of university academics from Australia, the UK and the US, that analysed the impact of public policy, particularly in COVID safety measures, and the willingness of various citizens to abide by that. And it shows that in Australia, Australians were more likely to listen to the messages on social distancing, to self-quarantine with signs of illness, and to behave oneself as far as hand washing, if they thought the government was looking after them. And that came across very clearly when they analysed the impacts of policies such as JobSeeker and JobKeeper. People would more likely, especially the younger they are, to self-isolate and to, you know, socially distance if they thought that they were also being looked after on the financial side. So I thought that was very interesting, and I think that is starting to come across very clearly in the communications from government.
Maria, I feel like this year, particularly from the Australian government, we've seen a bit of a sort of learning on the job from Scott Morrison, because obviously the year obviously started off with the bushfire crisis. And in fairness to him, the communication around that was not great at times, but certainly it's been a lot better through the COVID crisis. What's your take on all of that?
I think that's a very apt description. It definitely was a dimension of learning on the job, and it's very difficult for us to actually cast our minds back to the last summer, because it feels like we've all lived through about a decade this year. But yeah, that's absolutely right. The Prime Minister did make several, major kind of missteps, which did reduce public confidence in the things that Jeanette was kind of pointing to in that study, that the government would be looking after them in relation to bushfires. And then I guess to continue in a slightly critical vein, there was a lot of criticism, I suppose, of the government being slow to enact a public health response. And I guess one of the things that I'd like to know from our two experts is, well, what goes behind creating a public health campaign for an unknown disease in a pandemic that seems to be rapidly unraveling very quickly? I mean, how realistic were those criticisms of the government? Were they actually slow to act on that?
I think that sounds like a good question to throw to you, Fiona.
I think some of the criticisms were a little bit unfair, because there is a sense that you do want to get it right. You know, when you're in government and when you're you're going through this sort of a crisis. I mean, I don't think anyone could be criticised in government for not working hard enough, whether that's at a state or a federal level. I mean, you're in there for 14, 15, possibly more hours per day, 7 days a week. And I think the nature of today's media cycle where if you do make a small slip up or don't get something exactly right, you are crucified for it in mainstream media, on social media. Yes, the cycle moves on quickly, but I think that there is an element of wanting to make sure you take the time to get it right. Also, you know, working out the systems. And I think, look, if we look at, say, we can compare the bushfires and COVID very directly here. If we look at the use of app technology as a way of directly communicating with the population. So during the bushfires, Fires Near Me app became very popular. It was downloaded some 1.6 million times, you know, by January 2020. People were using it. They were really engaged with it. And then, of course, we had the COVID Safe app, which has been hugely controversial in terms of its functionality, its value, its effectiveness. And you could almost argue that that was rolled out too quickly. It came out before it was ready, and that then created a problem from a messaging point of view.
Jeanette, I mean, governments all around the world have struggled with their communication strategies and the communication styles this year. Do you think that the way that the Australian government has responded, and as we've talked about, you know, sort of Scott Morrison kind of learning on the job in terms of the development from how he was through the bushfires and into the COVID crisis, do you think the Australian performance in government communications has been exemplary? Has it been a model? Has it been a sort of a global leader?
I certainly think I agree with the comments that the Prime Minister has certainly learned his lessons from the terrible performance that we saw during the height of the bushfires, where he completely misread the community expectations and that terrible kind of forcing people to shake his hands when they were traumatised without kind of appreciating that wasn't what we wanted to hear. I think what they've learned, and I know this because I've spoken to the Minister for Health very early, that they made a very conscious decision to put the Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, front and centre of most of their communication on the health aspects, which kind of took away the politics of it. It made people feel very comfortable that they were getting clear, non-spin information from the government. And where it's worked well is when they've had the National Cabinet and all the premiers speaking clearly and alignment. Where it's fallen down is when they start to, you know, splinter and the politics rears its ugly head again. And I think that's going to be an ongoing challenge for them because we're, you know, yes, we're getting through the worst of COVID particularly well, better than most of the rest of the world, but we have a huge hurdle to now overcome when it comes to the vaccine and convincing every single Australian that they should take the vaccine when it's going to be available. And that is going to be an enormously traumatic challenge because, you know, the impact of social media, the access on those social media platforms of the anti-vaccinators, the anti-vaxxer campaign crowd will be terribly complicated for the government to manage. And that is where I think they're really going to have to work very, very hard to make sure that they become the only source of truth going forth.
I do want to talk a little more about the role of social media in government communications shortly. But first, I just want to pick up on something you said there, Jeanette, in terms of the increase we've seen on the amount of experts, chief scientists and the like, that are put out in front of the public to communicate this type of thing. Of course, there was that famous quote from Michael Gove where he said, you know, we've had enough of experts. Has the last year proven that in actual fact people haven't had enough of experts? They do want expert opinion when they're communicating sort of crucial health messages like this.
I was just going to say, working across a lot of medical researchers, I mean, there is an absolute appetite, and I think talking to News Corp journos, this is true, that the Australian public could not get enough of medical research breakthrough stories of of great Australian innovation in the treatments and I guess the chase for the vaccination. It's been a hugely popular story for all Australia, and I don't think that's dying down anytime soon. I personally was getting so tired of seeing Dan Andrews' daily press conference, but that I don't live in Victoria. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a little, you know, risk of being completely overexposed to the whole COVID-19 drama. But while we're still going through that process of getting a vaccine, I think the appetite by Australians for more information from people who they trust, being medical research community, doctors, the nursing community, I think long as the politicians keep out of the playing politics with it, then the Australians are more likely to listen to the authority of the medical research community and act accordingly to that advice.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that you're making there, Jeanette. And I guess another way of sort of thinking about it is to sort of say, well, it really depends on the experts, and it really depends on the problem. Like, I think when it comes to something like public health or even a bushfire crisis, though perhaps more arguable in the bushfires, I think it's much easier for the public to kind of recognise the expertise of medical practitioners and to accept that advice, because we're sort of trained to do that. You know, like, most people don't question their doctors when they go to the health service. And, you know, when your backyard is on fire, you're going to listen to the firefighter, right? Or most of us will. What I guess is kind of interesting is that when it's on contested public policy spaces, which are inherently actually just about trade-offs and there is no right answer, then I think it becomes, you know, I think that's in some ways what Michael Gove is kind of talking about. He's just trying to extend the argument and slur all experts, no matter where they are, whether or not people actually really do want to hear from experts anymore. And that might be because perhaps there is a perception that these experts have been kind of co-opted by political positions, and they're part of a political kind of narrative. And I guess I'd be really interested to sort of know what you two sort of think about, I guess, what has happened to the public sphere, because it seems to me like over the last sort of 15 years that in many ways the sort of civil society groups that we used to trust to contribute to public debate, like the unions or churches or welfare agencies, you know, or economists or whatever, the space or business even, like the space for them to kind of contribute to public debate seems to have kind of narrowed, leaving the kind of government at the sort of mainstream public sphere at the center of that, and everything kind of being in reaction to the government. But, you know, this proliferation of tiny conversations happening kind of privately in our own homes or in our sort of private digital kind of spheres. And so these kind of, you know, like experts are almost kind of like, well, this is my expert and this is your expert, and they're going to duke it out.
There is a very, I think underneath some of what you're saying there, Maria, I think we could talk about maybe climate change and sustainability as the obvious example.
Perhaps.
Where, you know, and that's certainly been a fascinating argument. You know, as Jeanette said, people have accepted and embraced having medical experts speak to them, which has then begged the question, why is there such reluctance to listen to sustainability scientists, climate change experts? And if only we had Frank Yotso here. But it's a really interesting dynamic, because that is just so polarizing. And I think it will become polarizing again, as Jeanette said, once we move into that space of having to get people vaccinated and the anti-vaxxer movement. And that's where, again, I mean, one thing that I did think was very interesting in COVID was, you would remember very early on, there is also a role not just for experts, but for expert communicators. And Norman Swan was just everywhere, and everyone was listening to him, and he was able to simplify the messages about hand washing and hand hygiene and things to a level that people were able to really engage with and follow. And he actually ended up getting a bit of criticism from the government at some point for almost taking over the role of government communications, which was fascinating. But he was filling a void, and he is an expert communicator. I mean, politicians are perhaps expert campaigners, but they're not always expert communicators. And I think the other thing I'd say is, as far as business goes, again, we've seen business stepping up in the sustainability space. You know, the Woolworths announcement about net zero, ANZ net zero. There is, in some areas, and in particularly these contested areas, I would argue that some of those businesses have gone beyond government, are pushing ahead. And we saw that with the same-sex marriage debate. It's a really fascinating dynamic.
Now, we've got, you know, expert sort of government communicators in the room. So I'd like to do a bit of a kind of thought experiment, sort of pulling out a little bit more around this whole thing about we've got this huge challenge coming up with vaccinations and how we're going to convince people to do that. As both you've said, Fiona and Jeanette, and you have also said, there is this sort of significant and probably growing anti-vaxxer movement. If the two of you were advising government in terms of their communications now, what would you be saying to them in terms of how they go about messaging to convince the public that they do actually need to get those vaccinations? Perhaps, Jeanette, if I start with you.
Sure. And I think, like I said before, I think it's going to be a singly most challenging communications strategy they would have to consider to roll out. Also considering that it will be rolled out in the height of a high stakes election year, which makes, the Prime Minister down, his temptation to play politics with this being, you know, quite easy to do. I mean, it will be very difficult. And I do believe actually that as soon as we get a vaccination a vaccine available, that the government will be looking for a way to start the election campaign as early as August. So I think though that has got great potential to really muddy the waters, because not only will the government be very tempted to, play politics with the fact that it alone has got this vaccine and it is delivering a safe solution to its citizens, it will also be tempted to draw the critics on board, the anti-vaxxers, people who want to run interference with an election campaign. So I think the absolute imperative would have to be make sure that the messaging is very simple and cut through. And that's going to be exceptionally difficult in such a highly charged political environment. But again, I draw back on this international research that was led by Monash Partners here. And one of the things that they looked at, what also motivated particularly young people who are most likely to be the least likely to take up some of these, you know, social distancing and other things, and maybe least likely to take up a vaccine because I don't believe that they are at risk, is using punishment. And they found that where someone was threatened with a fine or some other kind of punishment, they were more likely to step in line and do the self-quarantine. So whatever the communication messaging is, it will have to come very hard with some behavioural change demands, I guess. And if they're not going to make the vaccine compulsory, then how are they going to compete with the anti-vaxxers? How are they going to force people, literally, to take this vaccine if they don't make it compulsory? And I think that's going to be a huge challenge for it.
Fiona, what would be your strategy based on what Jeanette said there and what you said earlier? Perhaps it sounds like we need to roll out Norman Swan to do it in a slightly threatening way.
maybe. And look, I'm sure Norman will be one of many champions who will come on board as they launch into this vaccination campaign, which I think it's pretty clear they're already laying the groundwork for. I mean, there's a lot of messaging already about testing and really trying to educate the Australian public about what the testing regime looks like, so that once a vaccination is available, people will have some kind of understanding of all the steps that's gone through. So there's a sort of a safety element there. The announcement about the manufacturing facility in Australia. Again, people are more likely to trust something that was made in Australia. So I think, you know, they're already setting up that groundwork. I think, you know, there's a question around carrot and stick, as Jeanette sort of flagged. Obviously, they may be able to keep some travel limitations in place for people who don't get the vaccine. I think that becomes a bit of a stick. Likewise, and we saw this with childcare and the vaccination debate with childcare. If you tie government benefits and government payments to getting the vaccination, that's another big lever. But there will be certainly an element of myth busting that the government will need to do, and they will need to be very unified in their communications, and we can't have any sort of any gaps between the state and territories and the Commonwealth when it comes to this vaccination campaign. They've announced what the strategy is going to be, and I think we'll hear a lot more about that in coming months, who gets vaccinated first and how. And I think it's just going to be a rolling campaign, which is the right approach.
And I might just jump in there. That's actually going to be a really tricky area for the government to manage, because we've already seen that conversation coming out of America. There will be a huge expectation that everyone will get a vaccine when it's available, which is very unlikely to be the case in Australia. And there's already a lot of pre-positioning from the government to try and convince people that it does indeed have the capacity and ability to put Australia ahead of the queue. And there's been a few false starts on signing agreements with various vaccine providers. And they're, again, because this will be landing at the base of a highly charged election year, I think the messaging it will have to deal with on who gets that vaccine first, who gets it last, what's the time lapse between that, and how are they going to keep people calm and, you know, stop the, I guess, a stampede on your local pharmacy as soon as, you know, the word is out that there is a vaccine available. I think it's going to be, I know that they're terribly sensitive about that already, and there's a lot of concern that maybe they can't deliver the vaccine as expected when it's available.
Now, I do want to take a break in a second, but before we do, all this talk about a vaccine reminds me of something that I saw on Twitter last week. There was a story that came out of the UK that a vaccine that they were working on apparently has a 90% success rate, which is a terrific story. And I looked at a story about that on Twitter coming out of the UK, and it was followed by literally hundreds of messages from British people saying, no way am I getting this, you know, and the anti-vaxxer theme was coming on strong there. So we've talked a lot about Australian politics, but Maria, I want to kind of pick your brains about UK politics for a second and get you to reflect a little on how well they have messaged the coronavirus crisis and what particular challenges they might have in terms of getting that message out about a vaccine.
Well, I don't think they've done a very good job at all. I mean, they haven't. I mean, Britain is basically coming down into more lockdowns. The messages around the COVID virus have changed an awful lot. There is a vicious and fraught debate about pitting the economy versus people's lives in a way that, you know, is a much more amplified than that debate we sort of saw in Melbourne, because, you know, there is a fear that public hospitals will be overwhelmed again. The Dominic Cummings has just left Downing Street. He's, you know, Boris Johnson's kind of key strategist, and there are sort of regular reports coming out of Downing Street that Boris is demoralised and effectively struggling to do the job. And I guess there is a sort of, I guess reflecting on that study that Jeanette referred to at the beginning, I think there is a deep sense amongst many citizens in the United Kingdom that the government isn't necessarily always looking out for them, and perhaps putting economic interests first. We saw that with the Eat in the City voucher scheme, which seems to have sort of perpetuated the virus. And then there's also just resistance in many parts of the country to following rules, perhaps because there is a sort of feeling that the NHS can't cope in winter normally, and government services aren't there normally, and now they aren't there at this time of great crisis. So I'm not surprised that people are lacking trust in the government's capacity to deliver a vaccine, even if they might have high trust in the NHS's capacity to care about them, even if they can't care for them.
Because some of their messaging, some of the UK messaging, government's messaging at the outset was quite clear and it cut through. They had the whole thing where they, you know, sort of
stay home, save the NHS. Yeah.
Exactly. And yeah. The clap for carers, the whole country seemed to be pulling together, but now it all seems to be falling apart. So, as you said, Dominic Cummings has gone. So, Boris Johnson is presumably looking for the next Dominic Cummings. Perhaps he might turn to you, Maria. What kind of advice would you give him in terms of that vaccine?
So, I mean, the little I do know about vaccines and anti-vaxxers is that you always get about 1% of the population that will always refuse a virus. Like that's just it's just a quirk of human nature. But that most people are responsive to being given information if it's facilitated by a trusted source. And so, I mean, both Fiona and Jeanette sort of spoke about different incentive sort of structures. And I think one of the ways that no jab, no play kind of works is that you can eventually kind of register to be a conscientious objector, but you have to basically go through your GP, receive lots of information, be given lots of opportunities to change your mind. And most people get the vaccine. And I imagine a similar layered strategy will need to be applied in a place like Australia and a place like especially potentially a place like the UK. I mean, we all kind of know that the first people getting this vaccine are going to be healthcare workers, and that the success of the vaccine amongst healthcare workers who are trusted and who are expert may actually help to alleviate some of the concerns of the public as well. As you know, I mean, literally the people who would be looking after you if you got COVID are taking this vaccine.
That sounds like a strong job interview for Dominic Cummings' position there if Boris Johnson is listening. And
I'm sure it's too wet in the UK. I don't like it.
All right. Well, this sounds like a perfect moment to take a quick break, but join us again shortly. When we come back, we'll have a talk a little about the role of social media in government communications.
I like sunshine.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Well, welcome back. I am still here with Maria Taflaga and Jeanette Cottrell and Fiona Benson, and we are having a fascinating discussion about government communications in the COVID era. I want to start off part two by talking a little about social media and how that has changed government communications, how significant it is that politicians are able to just jump online and communicate directly with constituents. Perhaps, Fiona, if I can get some reflections from you on that first.
Having your boss access their own social media is every media advisor's worst nightmare. You're quite often cleaning things up. But look, it is fascinating. And before coming in today, I just had a bit of a look because I hadn't sort of checked recently. And looking at our leaders' social media performance, there is a strong case that they really need to up their game. The PM, I have to say, kills it in terms of the opposition leader when it comes to followers, when we're looking at platforms and therefore reach. I mean, Instagram is one of the biggest and fastest rising platforms on the social media landscape. And, you know, poor old Albo's only got 49,000 followers, whereas the PM's got, you know, 220,000 or more. I mean, they both lose out to Jacinta Ardern, who's got a whopping 1.6 million. And then, of course, Chris Hemsworth at 45 million leaves them all for dust. But the point is, like, it is such a direct way of communicating. There is no filter. And it's a really important part of any strategy these days is being able to have a really strong social media presence, both organically. And then, of course, when you come to campaign time, that sort of paid promotion, you can target the demographics, the geographics. It's an extraordinarily powerful tool. And you can also, obviously, we've got the Twitter trolls and everyone else, but you can also have real advocates in your camp fighting your battles on social media. You'll see in the comment threads where, and where this is again what we're going to see with COVID, is these opposing camps doing battle in the digital sphere.
Sounds to me like Anthony Albanese needs to audition for the role of Thor, perhaps, to increase his...
Or get a puppy.
Or get a puppy. That's exactly right. Jeanette, what are your reflections on social media and the way it's changed government communications?
Oh, I think it's had a profound impact on the way that they communicate. I mean, we've seen from the very early part of this year, even pre-COVID, you know, Scott Morrison was under increasing criticism for being a little too confected on social media. He would have these complex videos and especially with the bushfires, it looked like he was doing these meeting the locals who were being affected just to have it filmed to upload it to social media. And I think that lack of authenticity really kind of comes back to bite them at some end. I think it's interesting, even just today, my colleague JWS researcher John Scales had some analysis of the Queensland election, and it showed that 17% of voters got their information from the ABC, but the exact same amount got their information from Facebook. So it's no longer regarded as the, you know, the poor man's, you know, media outlet. It is a significant social media contributor, and I think the both parties and all parties need to start to work out how to reach in an authentic way those who use social media when you've got other things running interference, like the accusation of fake news that Trump made so famous. And, you know, how do you determine what's accurate and what's not on social media? And that this is, again, I guess, where the social media players, the, you know, Google and TikTok and the like, they have a responsibility, and a very important one, particularly when you come to the truth of vaccines, on making sure that people are getting as accurate as possible the information via social media.
So, Maria, clearly the role of social media is becoming ever more important when it comes to government communications. But we hear a lot as well about how social media creates kind of bubbles where, you know, people really only tend to follow and be interested in those people that reflect or agree with their own views. So how much of a problem is that creating for us in terms of getting government communications out to the entire community?
Yeah, I think that's sort of one of the sort of essential challenges of something like social media. And I guess in some ways I don't want to be alarmist about this, because whenever we actually introduce a new form of media, if we look over the very long run, we see that politicians actually really struggle to learn to communicate on on this new communication device. You know, like FDR was considered to be excellent on the radio, for example, and Menzies was seen to be excellent on the radio and not very good at TV. You know, Gough was great at TV. Billy McMahon sucked at TV. So we can kind of sort of see a similar sort of thing going on here. I guess what is different about all of those other forms of communications, you know, radio, television, is that in some ways social media is returning us to the landscape of the proliferation of newspapers that used to exist in the 19th century, many of which that just published lies. You know, that's where the term yellow journalism kind of comes from, and all of that kind of stuff. And what is sort of really kind of fascinating from my perspective about the incentive structure that social media seems to create for politicians is that it pits a very highly disciplined system like Australia, where party discipline is really strong, one of the strongest in the world. The incentives are all there to follow the line, against
this need to be seen to be authentic. And this is not such a big problem for party leaders because, or, you know, and most senior ministers, because they have stuff to talk about anyway and they have the authority of their office. But it's the younger ones that are sort of desperately trying to get attention, who are sometimes very effective at using social media to sort of create like an authentic kind of voice, and are clearly working out how to have like discussions online. And that's sort of pitting them against, I guess, these sort of more centralized talking point filtering kind of machines coming out of centralized offices. And I'm really curious to see how this conflict kind of plays out over time. And the sort of final thing I would kind of say about this is one thing that does concern me is that we still don't seem to know how to have positive conversations in this environment. It's very reactive, really good at destroying stuff. And we've seen oppositions do that very effectively. But building arguments, because it is fragmented, because it doesn't have a centralizing mass audience, seems to make it very difficult to push reform agendas forward.
I'm impressed that we've had a conversation about social media and government without anyone using the words great work, Angus. But one thing that I do want to pick up on on social media is, of course, Donald Trump and the way he uses social media. And obviously through the US election campaign, some social media platforms have started slapping warnings on his tweets and on his posts about the authenticity of the views that he is expressing there. But perhaps, Jeanette, if I can get your thoughts on this, how has Donald Trump sort of manifestly changed the way that social media is used by politicians?
Oh, I think he has had an extraordinary impact on not only the way we view social media, but how his own citizens have learned to take information from him to the point where he is exceptionally dangerous in some of his views because they're uninformed or they're, especially, you know, right now, the claims that totally unsubstantiated claims that the election has been rigged, that there's been rorts, that there's been corruption. And to the credit of those platforms, to a certain extent, they're trying very hard to kind of challenge any claims that he's making that are untrue. And some of the mainstream media are refusing to obviously run some of his press conferences, which has been unprecedented, I would say. But the fact that he uses Twitter as just this foghorn to say whatever he comes to his mind at 3 a.m., has been extraordinarily challenging, and I can't imagine how difficult it will be to cut through all that crazy noise that he's created. The, you know, this whole demonizing the mainstream media as fake news, pumping up very sort of right-wing groups to the point of frightening anarchy on the streets where people are starting to protest in his name, bearing arms. I mean, it's not just a Twitter he puts out. It's a call to arms through some very, you know, worrying groups there. So I think the impact he's having right now is devastatingly bad, and one hopes that Australia would never go down that pathway. But again, it's a big challenge for these platforms themselves to not only, I guess, make judgment calls about what has been accurate or what is not, but also appreciating that the end result is whipping up some hysteria among, you know, some very hardcore groups that could lead to violence in America. It's extraordinary.
I guess these social media platforms are running up against the sort of social license problem. And I think what is kind of interesting from an Australian perspective is that they're very quick to act in the United States and in the UK because they clearly make a lot of money there and they're afraid of being regulated. Whereas in Australia, you know, the market is small, the profits are small, they're highly resistant to taking steps and taking action here. And also, you know, there is this current legislation that the government has put up to force media platforms to share profits with local media operators here because, you know, that's the information that people mostly are getting on Facebook. You know, it's often via traditional sources, just distributed by Facebook. And, you know, we see Google threatening to and Facebook basically threatening to withdraw from our
from our market, and it's a major concern for every country that doesn't have 400 million plus people.
Now, we've only got a few minutes left of talking about this really fascinating subject, and I'd like to spend the last few minutes talking about some kind of nuts and bolts of government comms. And one thing that I find particularly interesting, and I'll put this to you, Fiona, is that there are some policies which simply never rise above the sort of poor framing that they have in their initial introduction. And the examples here might be, you know, Gillard's fixed carbon price, which he conceded up front would be a tax, or the coalition's union busting bill, or the other one on religious freedom, both of which were gently shelved. What sort of role does that initial framing have in terms of its ultimate success?
Oh, it's extraordinarily important, and you can focus group test the hell out of something and it can still be an absolute flop. So a lot of it also comes down to, in many cases, how good the opposition is. You know, and a really quick-witted opposition can kill something very, very quickly, or taint it forever. You know, you mentioned the carbon tax, which is, you know, a historic, it's hard to even really describe in a few words what was, you know, such a, I remember sitting in Parliament watching that legislation pass at 3 a.m. in the morning, only for it to then be repealed. But you know, like you, at the same time, I remember Gillard, announced a policy that the opposition quickly turned into, cash for clunkers. So that was the end of that very, very quickly. The Mediscare campaign of the 2016 election was another really interesting one. That was a very negative campaign that got quite a lot of traction. And even though it was challenged, an investigation was eventually dropped into the direct text messaging that formed part of that. So it really, the Australian government spends, $210 million a year on advertising. It's an extraordinary amount of money. A lot of those campaigns are remarkable only for how utterly boring they are and not at all memorable. There are a few that fall outside of that category. There was a lot of controversy in the lead up to the 2019 campaign around the use of government advertising, I say, doing air quotes, promoting some energy policies, and that was then the subject of an ANAO audit. But it's a huge amount of money that gets spent in government advertising, often very ineffectively, would be my summation.
Jeanette, it sounds to me like what Fiona is saying there is that a lot of the potential success for a policy can come down to essentially a battle of wits between government communicators. Is that a fair read?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the interesting thing we've seen, I guess, more recently, which will be fascinating to see if it survives past the beginning of next year in the election cycle, is the government has tried very hard to be unified, the national cabinet approach, not putting politics ahead of policy. That obviously won't last for much longer. One hopes it would, but I doubt it will. I think everything is about how a message is presented, how it gets cut through. You know, you're right, there's policies that, you know, Parliament is littered with the corpses of policies that might have been a good idea, but because the communication underpinning it was complete failure, they have never got past getting the policy passed in Parliament. And, you know, there's even most recently as the government's free childcare, which was a terrific piece of social policy. The government was warned at the time not to use the word free, maybe to use the word removing the gap on subsidies, because turning off the free childcare would be a very difficult thing. And the fact that it went back to a childcare subsidy that was perfectly fine was a good piece of policy. But again, because it didn't explain it very well, it sounded like it was taking away free childcare away from families, that it was turning off the job seeker, job keeper to childcare workers, which wasn't quite the case, but it just didn't explain what it was doing very well. And And it probably got marked down for a policy that was working very well. So it was probably more of a missed opportunity than a bad policy. But that's the key. If the government wants to get rewarded for good policy decision-making, it has to articulate what it's trying to do in very clear, very easy to digest messaging. And that obviously doesn't happen very, very often or very well, which is, you know, the mistake many governments make all the time. But I think particularly when it gets in areas that the messaging is absolutely vital, like the rollout of a vaccine program, the communication has to be absolutely perfect and underpinned by evidence-based research, not polling focus groups, but real evidence-based research.
So a final question, which I'll put to Fiona first and then to you, Jeanette, and then perhaps Maria, if I can get your reflections on it at the end. What communications methods and processes are we leaving behind in this sort of brave new world of social media and getting experts to front the camera to talk about important public health messages? And what should government communicators be thinking about doing differently from now on?
That's a really interesting question, Martin, because I would almost argue that despite all of the changes that we've seen, government communication still follows a very old school traditional model in some respects. You know, it's always the government always likes to sort of drop an announcement out to the newspapers so they get a clean run without any external commentary, you know, to start the following day. And that's followed up by a round of radio. And then we've got the doorstop to get the pictures for the TV nightly news and, yeah, throw in a couple of social media posts. So what I find interesting is how little some of that very traditional, very long-standing media practice has been in terms of government communication. But I think, you know, Maria touched on it very well before when she said, as far as social goes, it's all about, you know, authenticity. What Jeanette said about campaigns being underpinned by evidence-based research. People will want to look up, they'll want to see for themselves that the information is there somewhere with a .gov.au URL. So that's what it's really going to come down to. But yeah, that would be my observation is how little things have changed in some respects, given the magnitude of change on other fronts.
And Jeanette, what's your take on that?
I think that they're great points. And I think one thing I've observed over the years, 20 years of being in Canberra, is a conservative government like the one we've got in place at the moment is leaning more and more and more towards the right-wing media, being mostly, I guess, News Corp and Sky News. And that suits their audience, that suits their level of comfort, but I'm not entirely sure it's serving the greater Australian public the best. And I think there needs to be a really strong, mindful diversion away from just those, you know, right-wing bugles from the media. That, yes, they're, you know, they're all very good newspapers and they're very good media outlets, but there becomes a power imbalance of media capacity to analyse the government's policies, to pick apart their behaviour, to really ensure that there's thorough investigation of what the government is doing. And I think that is going to become a stronger and stronger point of concern for, I guess, observers like myself and everyone on this panel, if the government continues to just tend to favour its media outlets that are more to its political cover. And I think that is a real issue. And I think social media has an ability to, I guess, challenge that. But at the same time, we just have to make sure that the media is a very strong, challenging beast that takes up the arguments against the government, that we're not just, you know, listening to policy being announced without it being properly tested.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that you make there, Jeanette. And I suspect the reason why it happens is because it's just simply easier. But I guess I wonder what is the long-term sustainability of that when, you know, we're already living in a time where the status quo is shifting before our very eyes, and And we cannot continue to live in the glory days of 2019 or 2010 or whenever it is. And that ability to be able to actually be persuasive will be critical for any government seeking to pursue an agenda, because as Fiona ultimately said, you know, not much has actually changed in the terms of the way news is produced despite all of this churn, because certain processes actually need to be followed in order to produce verified high quality content. And despite the fact the way news is delivered has changed, you know, the work practices that are in place to see that information vetted and put through a normal media process shouldn't really change. Really. And so I guess we'll sort of see what happens.
Plenty of food for thought there, but we are going to have to draw this discussion to a close. It's been fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. So I'd like to extend huge thanks to our panel today, Maria, of course, Fiona Benson and Jeanette Cottrell. Thank you so much for sharing your views and your expertise with us. Listeners, I'd like to thank you too. Thanks for tuning in today. And for all those people who are tuning in to us for the first time through the GovComs Festival, do tune in again. You can get in touch with us. We're on Twitter as Apps Policy Forum. That's APPS Policy Forum. You can join us on Facebook. We're under Policy Forum Pod there. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We're always keen to hear your thoughts on what we do. And whilst you're there, don't forget to hit subscribe. But you can also find us on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you normally get your pods from. So Democracy Sausage will return with a fresh episode on Thursday. So from me, cheerio from now, and from my panel, thank you very much again.
Bye.
Thank you.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.